Okay. All right, can you be my forward guy? Why don't you scoot your chair right over here, and when I call for advance, you hit that right there. See that little forward button? Or can, maybe you can do it on that one. Okay? You're my man. Do we have a laser pointer? So it's a...
Yeah, it's a PowerPoint.
The PowerPoint. Well, what a turnout. Thank you so much for doing this. I understand you do this pretty regularly, but maybe not with this big a group. So thank you for coming. What I'd like to do tonight is just to show you an approach that I think is reasonable, legitimate, and appropriate for discussing this subject. When I do series like this, it's usually at least four lessons, sometimes six, sometimes eight. We have one. So obviously I had to pick and choose as to what we're going to do tonight. So about all I can do is to try to give you a feel for this, and then to give you some openings for taking it and running it with it if you want to. Because there's lots of material out there. You are really blessed to live in this age. When I was your age and was at Harvard University, I was privileged to go there for my master's degree. There was nothing that was written that was well done from a creationist standpoint, that was well done, that really built on the scientific evidence. There really wasn't anything. In the last 50 years, there's been an awful lot done in this area. And you're privileged to have at your fingertips hundreds of good materials. So if you're interested in pursuing this, I have an idea with a group this size. Some of you are having challenges in your own mind about this subject. I certainly did at your age. And I want you to understand that. I was a science math type person, and I had lots of very intelligent, influential teachers who impacted me, and I didn't know how to answer their arguments. And it was extremely challenging to my faith, which is part of why I like to do what I'm doing. Because I needed somebody back then to help me think through some of these things. So I hope maybe if some of you are facing some of those challenges in your own mind, that you'll listen very closely. I think you need to be at ease that there's a rational basis for belief in God in the natural world. And the longer I've studied it, the deeper my faith has become. I really believe that if I studied deeply in the sciences, that it would cost me my faith. That's wrong. I have stronger faith than ever, having studied a lot in the sciences. So, this is an approach tonight that's kind of a short synopsis of one particular aspect of this subject. And I kind of like this approach. We'll see how you like it. If I were doing this in a science classroom, I wouldn't start this way. I'm going to start with references to the Bible, since all of you are, you just went to church with me. So, I mean, that's okay in this setting. If I were in a science classroom, I wouldn't use the Bible at all. It's not necessary. I think it's inappropriate. Because the Bible's approach to answering this subject is an approach based on that we believe the Bible is the revealed will of God. In other words, it's based on revelation. It's not based on examining the natural world. It's based on what God said. And that's a different approach than science. So, I like in science classes to just use the scientific method as we look at the evidence of the natural world. But here, we'll start with this. You know the song, Our God, He is Alive? Let's sing one verse of it. There is beyond the azure blue a God concealed from human sight. He bends His skies with heavenly hue and framed the worlds with His great might. There is a God. Yeah. give up. We need to just sing. That is wonderful. You know who wrote that song? Anybody?
A.W.
Dukas. You know anything about him?
He was in the Turn Signal?
He did. He was the dean of Florida College also. When I was a student there, he was my dean. And I was privileged to literally sit in his chair because I became dean of Florida College. So this song means a lot to me. He was a great man in my view. And he wrote this song in the midst of the 1960s when the God is Dead movement was very active and alive and well. And it was a specific response to the God is Dead movement. Our God is alive. So the question is it reasonable to believe in God in this age of enlightenment, in this age of scientific progress? I can tell you, and you may even have some teachers at Auburn who would say this to you, I don't know. But there are plenty of teachers, I will tell you, who would say to you to believe in God is antiquated. That's like going back to the Middle Ages. Now, the only people that need God are people who don't know enough about the natural world, what science has unfolded for us. And they're kind of like people who said God has to make thunder and lightning. We know better that the natural world does that. And the more we learn about the natural world, the less you need God. Pretty typical view by an awful lot of folks. So they would say to you, no, it is not reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age. So, I believe it is. But let's start with a little scripture. You know that the Bible says in numbers of places that it's perfectly legitimate to appeal to some other source other than the Bible for the existence of God. So I want to establish for you, first of all, since I think most everybody in this room is a Bible believer, that the Bible itself teaches the same kind of argument I'm giving. So Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, night unto night reveals knowledge. There's no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. You notice in my version the word where is in italics. Is it in yours? Or maybe you don't even have the word where there. There is no speech or language. Their voice is not heard, I think is a better translation. Their line has gone out through all the earth and their words to the end of the world. In other words, what that's saying is the natural world is giving testimony even though you can't hear it. It's giving testimony that there's a God. So the testimony of the natural world. The stronger passage, go ahead, is Romans 1. I think that is the strongest passage in all the Bible that teaches this way of approaching the evidence for God. Romans 1:20. It says, "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." That passage argues, folks, that you can know there's a God, or you can have faith that there's a God, independent of this book. So let's see what the next one. His invisible attributes, you cannot directly observe God, so it must be indirect. And on what basis do you do that? Understood by the things that are made. In other words, if you examine the natural world and you see evidence in the natural world that something made this, that is a testimony that there is a grand maker who is behind it. That's the argument. It's called, in philosophy, the argument from design. I think it's always been the strongest argument from the natural world for the existence of God. So that's the argument I make all the time. It's the argument from design. And I think it's a powerful argument. It has nothing to do with this book. Independent of this book. So for the rest of our time, this book is going to be put away. We're not using this book. Don't have to. And one of the reasons I don't like using Institute for Creation Research materials, if you're familiar with that group out in California, is because they mix Bible material with science all the time. What you're doing when you do that is shooting yourself in the foot. Because if a scientist hears you quoting Genesis or quoting Romans or quoting some other scripture in connection with your investigation of science, they're just going to turn you off. Because that's two entirely different approaches to the topic. So I don't like mixing those two. It's not necessary. The Bible itself teaches God has given a grand testimony of himself in his other book, the book of the natural world. Okay. Keep going. All right, so here's how I want to start tonight. Do you believe, with all your heart, that there's intelligent life out there somewhere in the universe? You don't have to answer that out loud. Maybe you have never even thought about it. But if you did believe it, on what basis would you believe it? Are there signs of intelligent life in the universe? That's the question. Well, the fact is, people have been looking for it for a long, long time. There's an organization called SETI. We'll call it SETI. Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. That's been looking for a long, long time. When I was at Harvard, they were being supported by tax dollars to do the research, and my astronomy professor was right in the middle of it. He was a world-famous radio astronomer, and they were in a group of people worldwide who were looking for signs of intelligent life in the universe. And I'll tell you why. Because the belief in evolution was growing so strongly at that time, and there was such evidence coming to light that people were saying, look, it's going to be very short order before we understand how life came about. We're going to be able to create life. And it's so simple, it's relatively easy to happen, that it surely had to happen somewhere else. And there must be thousands of civilizations, even in our own galaxy. I mean, that was the common belief back in those days, in the 60s. So, that's why they were looking. They're still looking, folks, in the 21st century. Thankfully, they cut off the tax dollars because they didn't get one piece of evidence that's worth anything in all those years. So finally, the government said, okay, you can't have tax dollars anymore, but they're still looking. What kind of evidence would convince you that there are ETs, extraterrestrials? Now, why do I start that this way? Because to me, it's a great way to begin because it's a subject of interest to people. And there's a lot of opinions about it. So, what kind of evidence would convince you? Well, here is the website for the group that's still looking. So if you want to support them, they'll be glad to take some money from you. Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. This is their website. Here's some of the people involved. And you can't read this, but hit the next one, and we'll blow up this little piece. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is an exploratory science that seeks evidence of life in the universe by looking for some signature of its technology. So what are they looking for? Something that would identify that there's technology out there. And so how do you go about that? Next slide. Virtually all radio SETI experiments have looked for what are called narrow band signals. So if you're like me, when you came to church tonight, you dialed up on your radio, didn't you? Let's see, I was listening to 89.3, I think, FM, and they were playing classical music. It's wonderful. But you can dial to one place on your radio dial, and it transmits music. They're looking for that kind of signals from outer space because they know, here's what they say, these are radio emissions that are at one spot on the radio dial, hit the next one. Narrowband signals are the mark of a purposely built transmitter. Because natural cosmic noisemakers such as pulsars and quasars do not make radio signals that are this narrow. So here's what the SETI group would say to you. If we could receive from outer space a narrowband radio signal that had information in it, that is very strong evidence that there's somebody out there trying to tell us something. What do you think? Well, I think that's reasonable myself. Next slide. They're saying to us they can infer intelligent cause without knowing necessarily what that intelligence is. And that's a very important point, folks. I want to say that again. I believe we can infer intelligent cause without necessarily knowing all about what that intelligence is. That's what they're going to do when they get finished, because they're not going to know anything about it except the radio signal. But can you infer intelligent cause from the scientific evidence? I believe you can. And there's people trying to do it all the time. So don't tell me this isn't good science. I like this argument because it's scientific. Next slide. All right, so since they haven't found anything of substance in all these years, Carl Sagan, who was right in the middle of all this in the 60s, he's now passed from this life, and I have an idea he has a whole lot better knowledge now about God than he did before, wrote a book about it. Since nothing had happened, he wrote a fictional book called Contact. Who's read it? Nobody. Who's seen the movie? Okay, that's typical of our age. The book's better. Can you... You saw the movie. Was it a long time ago?
No, it was not a real long time.
Do you remember enough about it to kind of tell them?
Yeah.
Tell us about it. What's it about?
It was about some of the research. I don't know if they were with the SETI project or not, but they were trying to... They were trying to make contact, and they thought they heard something, and they tried to build this big, huge gyroscope machine, and were going to drop it to, I don't know, amplify it for some reason.
To try to send signal.
And Jodie Foster jumps in it, and they drop her down there, and then she gets warped to where her father was, some way off in a wormhole. And
you know, they add a lot of stuff to it. But the basic idea of the book was that they did make contact with some extraterrestrial civilization. You see all those radio telescopes. The whole point of it was they were combining to do it. Well, that's exactly the kind of research going on right now. They're looking for radio signals. And they claim it's a scientific enterprise. I'm not going to argue with that. I think they're using scientific methods. And frankly, if they truly could demonstrate that they received a signal from some point in space that contained information in it, like, help, come find me! I mean, if they could truly demonstrate that happened, that's pretty strong evidence. There's something intelligent out there. Now, have we found such a thing? No, we have not. But they're still looking. This is the signal they found in this book. Understand, this is fiction. But that's the signal they found. And they said that signal absolutely convinced them that it came from an intelligent source. That look intelligent to you? Well, that's because you haven't looked hard enough. Let's blow that up a little bit. Next slide. There it is. Does that help you? Let me tell you what this is. The ones on here are bleeps in the radio telescope. Meep, meep. The zeros are pauses. Okay, so let's look at it now. Click this for me. Two bleeps, right? And a pause. Go ahead. Three bleeps and a pause. Five bleeps and a pause. Seven bleeps and a pause. 11 bleeps and a pause. 13 bleeps. When you catch on, would you say something, please? Those are the prime numbers. Keep going. There's two, three more. What's the next prime number after 13? 17. And then? 19. And then? Well, it stops different. But if you keep going down this whole thing, you will have the first 25 prime numbers in the row. If you started right here and you counted all these ones, you'd get 101. Starting right here to here. That's 101. That's the 25th prime number. So tied up in this signal, ladies and gentlemen, is the first 25 prime numbers in a row. What's a prime number? A number divisible only by? One and itself. Now, what do you think? If we received a signal from outer space that contained the first 25 prime numbers in a row, would you say, isn't it interesting how that bleeping star did that? Nobody would believe that. If that really happened, every headline in every newspaper on Earth would say, for the first time in the history of mankind, we received a signal from an intelligent civilization. That's what they'd say. Don't you think? Nobody believes some natural phenomenon can produce the first 25 prime numbers in a row. That is incredible. So that's one of the kinds of signals they're looking for. And Carl Sagan wrote a book called Intelligent Life in the Universe about that thick. It was required reading in my astronomy class in 1968. And it was full of things like that, saying, here's what we're going to be looking for. And that was one of them. Well, since they didn't find it, he made it up and put it in his book. And in the book, they did find it. And I can tell you, everybody concluded in that book, that came from an intelligent source. That didn't happen naturally. You see the reasoning? Okay, go ahead. Sequence contains the first 25 prime numbers. Everybody concluded that came from an intelligent source. So here's my question. What if we received a message from space that had a language in it that we could learn to decode and read? And in the language it said, hello, we are civilization NC378ZX, located in the constellation such and such. We're looking for other intelligent civilizations. I'm serious. Suppose you received a signal that had that kind of information in it, and you were able to decode it and read it. Do you think anybody on Earth would say, isn't it interesting what the stars produce? Nobody would say that. They would say that was from an intelligent source. It requires intelligence to produce something like that. It's not natural phenomena. Okay? And I'd agree with that, by the way. All right. I'm telling you, there's signals of intelligent design all over the place, right here under our noses and in our noses. They're all over the place. Every living cell is full of signs of intelligent design. So why can't we use the same kind of reasoning right here on Earth? Go ahead. There is a language in every living cell. Did you know that? And we learned how to decode it and read it. We know exactly what it means. But down here on Earth, when you discover a language in some natural phenomenon, we say, isn't it interesting what evolution did? Somehow nature produced this language? You really believe this? And this language is doing things? I want to talk about that a minute. Research on DNA continues to reveal signs of design. Now, all of you, you're college students. You've all had this. So I can go through this real quickly, right? Because you all know it already anyway. Here's what Anthony Flew said in 2004. He was 50 years an atheist who debated creationists and belittled us that we had the notion of believing in some God. And here's what he said in 2004 at the age of 80 years old. It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. And Professor Flew has become a believer in a creator. I appreciate an 80-year-old man that will change it, a man that will change his mind. I hope I'm that flexible. Anthony Flew had to go where the evidence leads, he said. This evidence was so overwhelming to him that he said, I give up. There has to be somebody that designed this. I don't know how anybody can miss that, folks. But they do. Your professors in biology and chemistry and philosophy, most of them believe that stuff evolved by natural causes. They have more faith than all of Israel. So here's DNA. Go ahead. Everybody knows it has a certain characteristic structure, right? It's a double helix with crossbars. And because of its structure and the way it's lined out, it has the capacity to reproduce itself. And tied up in the DNA molecule is a language, ladies and gentlemen. It had never ceased to amaze me that my biology teachers would teach me this stuff and act as if, isn't it wonderful what we've discovered, and never get the idea that, well, how did that get there? They just gloss over that and say, well, isn't it wonderful what evolution produced? Listen, evolution is better than any God you ever wanted to create, if that's the case. How does DNA copy itself? Well, first of all of you probably know, don't you, that DNA contains crossbars here that are made up of four bases, right? Can you name them? Adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, right? And when you copy them onto messenger RNA, the thymine becomes uracil. So those are your four bases. Everybody knows that. Maybe not everybody, but there are four bases along the strands here, and just in a certain order. And what we've learned is those four bases come in three-letter words. Every word in this language is three letters. So let's do a little math. If you can use any of the four letters in any of the three spaces, how many words can you make? In the first space, you can use four different letters. In the second space, you can use four different letters. And in the third space, you can use four different letters. So how many words can you make? 64. It's 4 times 4 times 4. There are exactly 64 words in this language, because they're all three-letter words. And they're all made of those four letters. And what we've learned is when you read up the strand here, you're reading words. And we know exactly what those words mean. So you see, when the DNA unzips here, it exposes one side. And I will tell you, for a long time, back in the 60s and 70s, we thought that only one side was copied. Were you taught that in school? We now believe that both sides are copied. And one is called, I forget the terminology here, help me out, the side that's copied, that's standardly used for the messenger RNA to go out and build stuff, is called, say it again? Anyway, we're not having a test. But the fact is, we now know both sides are copied and they're used for all kinds of different interesting things. We're learning more all the time. But you can copy one side, the copy that's made, what's next on here? They can be read in sequence, every three letters is a word. I said that already. So let's talk about it now. You see this thing here? That's the messenger RNA that's making an exact mirror image copy of the information on this DNA. Everywhere you see a G, you get a C over here. Everywhere you see an A over here, you get a U over here, which is the replacement for thymine. And if you see a T over here, you get an A over there. It's exact reverse. Always those go together, like love and marriage and a horse and carriage. And so this is the mirror image of this. And once it's completed, this messenger RNA can be stripped off and sent off somewhere to do something else with that information. It is utterly incredible. And here's something else you need to know. That every step of this process to take the information off the DNA, send it somewhere else, and then make copies of it and do stuff with it requires proteins every step of the way. Alright? See this big purple blob up here? It doesn't look anything like that. That's just a picture. That's RNA polymerase. Now, you biology students, what's an ACE mean? A-S-E. That's an enzyme, and an enzyme is a protein. It's a very specialized kind of protein. So RNA polymerase is what allows this thing to unzip and make the copies, but it's a protein. I'm going somewhere with this, so just you're going to remember that, right? That's a protein. I have to tell you something else. Have you ever unzipped something and got it stuck? You know, the zipper got stuck? That happens with these guys too. So there's another protein specifically for the purpose of keeping the DNA from getting stuck. When it gets unzipped and zips back together. And by the way, did you know DNA is a humongous glob of stuff all together like this? And so when you're trying to unzip one piece of it, you think it might be easy to get stuck? One of the real challenges is for the DNA to get unzipped, copied, and zipped back together without messing everything up. The proteins are the ones that help that happen. Okay. Here, ladies and gentlemen, is a representation of the code that we have learned to read. in the language that is in every cell, in every living thing. It's called the genetic code. It's the three-letter words made of four bases that is in every DNA. And we know exactly what it means. So look, we're using U here instead of T because this is the messenger RNA code. So if the first letter is U, the second letter is U, and the third letter is U, this is what it means. It means fee. That helps a lot, doesn't it? Let's try this one. How about C-U-U? That means loo. Let's try this one. How about U-A-C? That's this one right here. That's tur. This is very helpful. I like this one. Arg. Arg. C-G-A is arg. Well, what you probably don't know is that all these are abbreviations for something. Does anybody recognize it? What are they abbreviations for?
Arginine.
Yes, and what are those?
They are
the common amino acids that make up all proteins. Listen to me, folks. What I just said is utterly amazing. And you just sat there like it was nothing. I want to say it again. What you have right here is a language with three-letter words, and each of those three-letter words means an amino acid. This one's phenylalanine, that one's serine, that's tyrosine, cysteine, leucine, proline, histidine, arginine, isoleucine, threonine. Did you have to memorize those? Yes! If you were in my chemistry class, you'd memorize every one of those and you'd learn their atomic structure. And why? Because you need to know how amino acids work, because folks, they are the building blocks for every protein and every living thing. So what you have here is a code, ladies and gentlemen, that allows the human body to code for building every protein in your body. That code is there to do that. It's a language. Folks, if I stop right there and said nothing else, we have discovered, if somebody discovered this from outer space, just this, nothing else. If we received a code from outer space that had the genetic code in it, a message, everybody on Earth would say somebody intelligent out there is trying to communicate with us. But since it's in the DNA in every living cell, isn't it interesting how this evolved by natural forces, by the blind forces of physics? It's what Richard Dawkins says in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. You don't need a god for this stuff. That just happened by natural causes. The blind forces of physics acted on by natural selection. I'll tell you what, if that's how that happened, that natural selection is God himself. That is ridiculous to explain it that way. That's a language, people. Nature doesn't produce languages that have information in them. But that isn't the beginning to start to begin to think about starting. That's nothing. Next slide. Here's what has to be done. Now you watch. See, we need about 6 weeks on this. Here's the DNA up here in the nucleus. And here it has to be copied, right? That's the messenger RNA. And by the way, you also have to get transfer RNA and ribosomal RNA at the same time. They're very important. We haven't even talked about that. But they're all coded up here. And then the messenger RNA has to be organized. It's called the maturing process. And then it has to migrate through the nuclear cell wall over here to the ribosomes. And then it's read like a tape through a tape recorder, and the protein comes out the bottom. And the order of the protein, which is amino acids, this is methionine and glycine and isoleucine and valine and glutamine and all the way down, the order of those amino acids comes from there. It's transcribed, migrated, and translated and builds the proteins. And ladies and gentlemen, every step of that process requires at least one, and in many cases two and three specific proteins. You didn't get that.
Oh.
You're getting better. I don't think you understand what I just said. Every step of this process of producing proteins requires proteins. But the proteins that are required to make this happen, guess where they're coded? Up there. You see what I'm saying? You have to have proteins to unzip DNA. But the protein you have to unzip DNA is coded in the DNA. How'd you get it the first time? So it could unzip the DNA. How'd you get it the first time? Yeah, and you know what evolutionists will say? Well, somehow that process happened so that you could get... That had to happen kind of at the same time. So now we not only have produced a language, poof, out of some physics, but we've produced the proteins that require you to copy and translate and migrate that are needed to start with, that are all coded in the DNA. It's a... It's a major problem. And my. You really believe that the code that was tied up in there, that is transcribed, transmitted, and then translated to produce proteins, came about by natural causes? The blind forces of physics, acting upon by natural selection. Incredible. But now I want to throw a monkey wrench in it. And I'll tell you what I've come to believe. I don't care how incredible something gets, there's going to be something thrown in there to throw monkey wrenches in believers. For believers. So as we learn more about the DNA, here's what began to happen. See, I went to school in the 60s. We were just uncovering all this stuff, and everybody thought, oh, we're learning so much, this is going to become so readily, easily available, we're going to know exactly how it all works. 50 years later, folks, it's 20,000 times more complex than we ever dreamed. But I'll tell you what we have learned, and that is this process of building proteins only requires about 5% of the total amount of DNA. That massively complex, wonderful process only takes about 5% of the DNA. And the more we learn about the DNA, you know, in your lifetime we've transcribed the whole DNA human genome, haven't we? That happened in your lifetime. And what they found in there, ladies and gentlemen, when they coded that whole DNA strand, they found a bunch of sections of it that were just repetitious. Just the same thing over and over and over and over and over and over again. They found sections in it that looked like they were supposed to code for something, but they didn't. And they found sections in it that looked like something had been chopped out. I'm making this very simplified, you understand? But the idea is this, and here's what an evolutionist would say to you, and I had it said to me in a debate. They said, Dr. Payne, I mean, you like to present this stuff and make everybody think this is so amazingly wonderful. What you haven't told this audience is that 95% of that DNA is junk. Only 5% of it's used for what you're talking about. And the rest of it's junk. Now, would some God make 5% good stuff and 95% junk? That makes no sense. That looks more like the random process of evolution that left all this stuff left over, and 5% of it happened to learn how to produce proteins. You see what I'm saying? There's always going to be things to throw in here to challenge your faith, ladies and gentlemen. And I will tell you, when that information came to light, I didn't know how to answer that. Would God make DNA that's 95% junk? I'll tell you what I have learned through the years. And I said this to that professor that night. I said, "Sir, I don't know how to answer all about that, but I will tell you this. I think you need to be a little careful about what you call junk. Because what looks to you like it might not have any purpose right now, and it may seem like leftovers of a bunch of evolutionary dead ends, give it about 20 years and maybe we'll figure out what that's what's doing in there. Let's not be so high strung in our views. Maybe the rest of that DNA is doing some amazingly wonderful things we don't know anything about right now." And I will admit, as a creationist, I would not expect God to have created DNA that has 95% junk. That doesn't make any sense to me. But wait a little while. Let's see what we find out. And I'm very happy to tell you tonight that in the last 10 to 15 years, we're already beginning to find out about that junk. So I want to just give you a little taste, and the only thing I'm trying to do tonight is to say to you, look, you're always going to have things thrown in there to challenge your belief in a creator. I believe God set it up that way. I'll tell you how far I've gone with it. You know, in 2 Thessalonians, where he says, those who don't want to believe the truth, he will send them a strong delusion that they may believe a lie and be damned. 2 Thessalonians 2. I don't know what that applies to the natural world, too. If you want to believe there's no God, he's going to send you enough stuff out there that'll make you think that. If you want to. But what I'm saying to you believers in this audience is, if there's something you can't answer, just wait a while. There's plenty of solid evidence upon which to build your faith. And if there are things you can't answer right now, just give it a little while. I have an idea we'll find out something more about that. And as challenging as it may be, and this DNA junk argument is one of them. What about junk DNA? Some say DNA is about 95% junk. I can refer you to lots of scholarly articles where that's exactly what they say. And they'll argue, why would some God do something stupid like that? You ever heard anybody talk about the design of the human eye and how ridiculously it's designed engineering-wise? That's until we discovered what were some of the features about it that caused it to be done exactly that way. So be careful what you call junk. There just may be something you don't know. Maybe the more humble thing to say is, let's wait a while and see what else we learn. On the junk argument, there's a wonderful new book out called The Myth of Junk DNA. I highly recommend it to you. The Myth of Junk DNA. And what he does is he tells you all about what we're learning about that junk. Can we go back? Go back. Keep going. I want to go back to that one right there. You see this right here? Messenger RNA, when it's copied up here, what we learned in the 70s and early 80s was that, in fact, that messenger RNA, as it was originally copied, has to be matured. You see these little white pieces in here? Has anybody studied enough about this to know what those are called?
What are the introns and extrons?
They're called introns, yes, sir. These white pieces are called introns, and evidently they're not used in the copy process, so they have to be snipped out. You see these white pieces that are here? They're not here anymore. So they were snipped out and put on the ends, you see, in some cases. In some cases, they're snipped out and something else is done with them. Well, you know what the evolutionists said about that? Why would a God design a mechanism whereby you're copying it up here and then you got to snip stuff out and make it mature? Why not just make it copy the right thing in the first place? You see what I'm saying? And introns became a hard line of evidence against creationists. intron. That's just more junk that you got to snip out and get out of the way. What a troublesome method that is. That's ridiculous. Nobody would design anything like that. Well, I'll tell you what we're discovering, ladies and gentlemen, is that those introns do all kinds of neat things. They have a number of purposes that we're discovering. And here's something else you need to understand. The same piece of the DNA up here, now we know, can produce probably 100 different proteins by reorganizing it just like this is reorganized. So the same piece of information has more information than you ever dreamed because it can be reorganized and form different proteins. That's what we're learning. So what folks at one time thought was junk, we're learning not necessarily junk, but has a very fine use. Let's go back now where we were. And all I'm going to do is just highlight it. What we're learning is the DNA is much more densely concentrated and specified than we ever dreamed. Multiple messages are stored in the same sequence of bases. Keep going. There are spliceosomes and editosomes. And you know, that means they're specific proteins to splice and edit pieces. That's their job. Doesn't that make it look like a plan to you? They're codes within codes, we're learning. They're dual and overlapping messages in the same DNA piece. And it's illustrated in that book this way. There was a letter written during the Revolutionary War, written by somebody behind the enemy lines, and written to somebody over there to the Americans who were then fighting the British to explain stuff to them. But the letter said stuff like, well, the farm work is going well, you know, the plants are coming in, we're milking our cows, everything's fine. You know, it's telling about family and normal events. But to the person who read it, they gave the code, and tied up in that letter was information about enemy lines, about battle levels, and about all the ammunition they had and where everybody was. So in that letter, which made sense in and of itself, there was another code that told them about the enemy. Folks, that takes intelligence to do that. So what we're learning is, go back now to the other one. What we're learning is that in the DNA messages, there are dual and overlapping messages in the same sequence of bases. And that there's codes within codes. You're going to tell me that natural selection acting on the blind forces of physics produce codes within codes? That makes no sense. Okay, keep going. We're also finding that within the DNA system, there are files within folders, making retrieving, manipulating, and expressing the information rich data more efficient. Do you ever have a messy desk and you kind of find something? Imagine a massive DNA molecule crammed full of information. How are you going to find what you need in there? I'll tell you what we're learning is that a lot of that DNA that they thought was junk is the DNA that's kind of like a massive, what do you call it for a computer that makes it run? There's a system that makes all this. The operating system. What we're learning is that the DNA has an operating system in it that organizes, similar to words, sentences, and paragraphs. Go ahead. There are genes, gene folders, and superfolders, and isocores, megafolders inside that DNA, folders within folders within folders within folders to organize it. And there are parts of it to help that process take place. And guess what it takes to help make that happen? Proteins that are also coded in the DNA. Next, we're also learning that the organism provides an informational context. DNA alone does not wholly determine the morphology of an organism. There are also cell types that impact it. And there are organs made of specialized arrangements of cell types, and there are body plans. All of those things we're learning impact the morphology of an organism, not just the DNA. And so it's much more complex than we ever dreamed. And so the fact is, junk DNA, which became a big argument in the 90s against creationists, is turning out to be a myth. Don't believe me? You go look up for yourself. Did you know that in the 1850s there was a gentleman named Wiedersheim in Germany who said the human body is a veritable museum of leftover relics from our evolutionary past? He said there are over 150 vestigial organs in the human body that are leftovers of our past. The appendix. We don't need an appendix. It's a leftover from when we were a rabbit. And there's a tailbone back here. We don't have to have that. It's a leftover from our evolutionary past when we really did have a tail. Etc., etc. He listed 150 of those. You know how many of them we think today are vestigial? None. Unless you talk to some evolutionists. A few of them think there's three or four more that are still. Like the muscles in your outer ear. Why do you need muscles in your outer ear? I think I need some muscles there. I can wiggle my ear someday. There's still a few that people claim are leftovers of your past. But look, what Wiedersheim said was a veritable museum has become, we now know what these things do, and they have great need for the body. And the same thing's happening with DNA. All right? If SETI received a message from space containing nothing but the genetic code, everybody would include intelligent design. But add all the other stuff to it that it does to make and build proteins. It's overwhelming. Next. So I say, is it reasonable to believe in the age of enlightenment that God is alive? I say it's more reasonable than ever. Go ahead. Is that the last one? I'll keep going. Everywhere we look, from the macroscopic to the microscopic, things look like they're made. Sure looks like they're designed. Next. Or as Beatty says in his wonderful book, Darwin's Black Box, there's a loud, clear, piercing cry of design everywhere you look. So I believe, ladies and gentlemen, it is more reasonable than ever. And in fact, we have less excuse than ever of missing that there's a God who did this. Because it's opened up to us a whole world that we didn't even know anything about. That's my talk for the moment. So I hope that at least tinged you just a little bit. And if you want a bibliography, just send me an email and I'll send you a bibliography of all kinds of wonderful books you can dig into. Some very current. The two I'd recommend for tonight are The Myth of Junk DNA and a book called Signature in the Cell by Stephen's last name. I can't think of his last name. Anyway, Signature in the Cell. Those are phenomenal books, very current, published in the last 2 years. All kinds of information that will help you. Okay, sir, I'm done.
Very good.
Thank you for the time, and I hope it kind of opened your minds to some things that you can further explore.
Why don't we do this instead of passing out song books and singing? Do we have about 3 songs we have memorized we could sing, maybe finish with Our God, He is Alive, and then we'll be dismissed. Would that be okay?
Yeah. Probably able to turn this off because it's hot.
Okay. So.
Putting out a lot of heat.
Yeah. Who would like to lead?